Well, welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. We are committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds, and today will be no exception. Today I'm hosting Neil Thomas. He wrote a book that I hope all of you will read, a book titled Taking Leave of Darwin. And before I formally introduce him, I want to underscore the significance of the subject matter that we're going to be talking about today. And I'll do that by starting out with the words that more consequences for society hinge on the issue of origins than on any other. Harvard scientist Ernst Mayr said this. He said that the Darwinian Revolution of 1859 was perhaps the most fundamental of all intellectual revolutions in the entire history of mankind. And as Dr. Michael Denton put it, the 20th century cannot be comprehended apart from the intellectual revolution that the theory of evolution produced. In fact, Denton dubbed the theory of macroevolution the great cosmogenic myth of the 20th century, a myth that has produced far-reaching consequences in every discipline of study, in every level of education, and in every area of practice. Think about this. Karl Marx, the father of communism, saw in Darwinian evolution the scientific, the sociological support for an economic experiment that eclipsed even the carnage of Hitler's Germany. And Sigmund Freud, this is a great example, he, the founder of modern psychology, was also a faithful follower of Darwin. And his belief that man was merely a sophisticated animal led him to postulate that mental disorders were the vestiges of behavior that had been appropriate in earlier stages of evolution. So Denton was right. Evolution is one of the most spectacular examples in the history of humanity of how a highly speculative idea, an idea for which there's really no hard scientific evidence, has come to fashion the thinking of a whole society and to dominate the outlook of an age. The evolutionary misreading of the book of nature, well, it's simply breathtaking. And I suppose that this breathtaking cosmogenic myth needs to be exposed, and to have it exposed by someone who is not a Christian, but rather a humanist rationalist, is, well, I would say delicious. I think it's important to recognize that Neil Thomas, in writing this book, has been lauded by many intellectual luminaries. Neil Thomas has been called rightly a British humanities professor, a lifelong rationalist who once was rather confident in the claims of Darwinian orthodoxy. But as Michael Bee has well said, and Michael Bee is the author of Darwin's Black Box, Thomas's book, Taking Leave of Darwin, demonstrates the courageous and commendable willingness of a committed agnostic intellectual to change his mind about Darwin, to follow truth wherever it leads. The endorsement of this book by Dr. Paul Beasley Murray is also well worth repeating. I'm taking this from the cover of the book where Dr. Paul Beasley Murray says, Taking Leave of Darwin by Neil Thomas, a senior academic literary historian and a life member of the British Rationalist Association, is an unusual book. Why? Because it is an attack on the secular theory of evolution by a non-Christian. He goes on to say that Thomas describes the whole Darwinian edifice as an offense, not only to the best scientific practice, but even an offense to common sense. Indeed, he says that to attribute creative potential to nature, well, it's a deeply archaic animistic way of thinking. And he concludes that with the naturalistic, materialistic alternative having failed so signally, we are left with no other choice but to consider the possibility of the God hypothesis. One other endorsement that deserves recognition as I kick off this podcast comes from Professor Michael Flannery. He says, well, much the same as what you have heard so far in the endorsements that I have communicated. He notes that Neil Thomas, a highly perceptive scholar, has laid bare the bold presumptuousness of the Darwinian faithful for what it is, namely a modern form of hoodwinking that fails an honest and unbiased test of history and logic. And so he says of taking leave of Darwin that it exposes the science of Darwinian evolution as not science but scientism, as well as the explanatory power of natural selection, as will the paper Tiger of Nature Red in Tooth and Claw. He concludes by saying, read this book and be fooled no longer. And that's exactly what I want people to do. The long introduction simply to say, this is a book that is must reading, a book that you can find on the web at equip.org. We make it available for anyone who stands with us, shoulder to shoulder, in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org. Again, the book available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. I want you to read this book. It is a book that I think is transcendently important, and I've spent many, many years on this subject myself. So when I say that, I'm talking about a book that is not only instructive, but a book that is very, very well written. With that, I want to introduce the author, Neil Thomas, and again, the book Taking Leave of Darwin. Thanks so much for joining me on Hank Unplugged.
You're welcome.
So let's start with this. How did your journey start? Your formal training and expertise are in classical studies and European languages. So what led you to write a book investigating evolutionary theory?
Yeah, it came about even as a surprise to myself, actually, because I've been retired for a number of years now and have built something of a second career in the realm of small business. And I had sworn blue blind to my wife that I was not going to write another book. I've written many in my time on more abstruse subjects than this, I might say. One index, about 20 years ago, I was at a conference when a female academic from Oxford used the word memes, which is Richard Dawkins' word for transmissible cultural units from one person to another and so on. And I thought, well, why on earth bring memes to the feast? We've got enough jargon in literary criticism as it is. And I don't quite, you know, it was certainly a distaste for the crudities and distortions of sociobiology came into it. And a distaste for Richard Dawkins's drive to Darwinize the whole of human existence, as it seemed to me. That was at the intellectual level, and that was two decades ago when I was in post. I suppose latterly I've had a more visceral response. In a strange to relate, a dream I had, I just woke up with a start and thought, well, Darwinism cannot be right. And I felt that all attempts by Darwinist successors, by modern cosmologists like Lawrence Krauss and so on, to say that there was a process of automatism of some sort, they're rather vague on the details, informing and driving forth the universe and its evolution, seemed to me wrong, just flat out wrong. And I think that's really what I thought, well, what can I do? And I thought, well, it's no good kicking yourself at being so credulous for so many decades. Do the responsible thing and try and research the matter, which I did. And the rest is history. I mean, it's an absorbing subject, as you know yourself very well. And it's an important subject. In fact, perhaps there's no other more important subject in the world. And so I was drawn into it. And it was from that point of departure that the book actually began to be written.
Yeah, well, talk about some of the implications right at the outset. I mean, if you think about the implications of Darwinian evolution, the impact it's had on civilization, it is no small thing. I mean, one of the things that immediately comes to mind, of course, is eugenics.
Mm-hmm.
And eugenics has had a huge impact on people around the world, and its origin goes back to the work that Darwin popularized.
Yes. I mean, there are a number of negative byproducts that Darwin has thrown out into the world. I wasn't concerned with that directly, although I am beginning to get interested in this whole subject of sociobiology, as it was called. They call it evolutionary psychology now for tactical reasons, because sociobiology was seen as something rather suspect latterly. What I would say in response to the question I think you're asking me to respond to is that whilst I have not been for the bulk of my adult life a practicing Christian, my wife is a practicing Christian and I have many Christian friends. And one of the things that has annoyed me about this is that in the year 2008, the Anglican Church, the Church of England, came out to deliver a fulsome apology to Charles Darwin rather late in the day for getting him wrong. And I thought to myself, well, I don't think the church did get Darwin wrong. I think Darwin was wrong, and the church has, in a kind of genuflection to the false god of science, which can be as flawed as any other god, as we've come to realize, that it was that I felt that the whole démarche of apologizing was wrong, because I think that the church has more of a title to rationality, if you like, in the sense that it has a conception of an unmoved mover, a first cause, a causa causarum, and to give it its technical term, that something must have an origin. Nothing comes of nothing, to give it the old Latin tag translated. And I do feel, you may call it a vicarious feeling, because as I say, I have been more of what we would call in Britain a humanist than a Christian for many decades, but I do feel a sense of injustice that it's as if the jury has been misdirected by a mischievous judge. And I feel that perhaps one of my strengths, and I make no bones about it, I'm not a scientist, I'm interested in science, but I'm not a scientist, but I do feel that I bring a sense of unbiased analysis to the whole thing. I mean, biologists after Darwin have been marking their own homework for 160 years plus now. And I feel that the kind of tendentious bias that they've brought to their studies has really not been correct. It's been something of a disgrace. And I simply wanted to try and correct what I think is a grand historical misperception. Sorry, that sounds a bit grandiose, but you have asked me to try and link to the point that you made.
Yeah, and I think you did so ably. I'm thinking right now as you speak about an epigraph in your book by Cambridge etymologist William Thorpe, who said that it was odd that scientists are so susceptible to self-hypnotic indoctrination, you know. And and I think in this regard that it is possible that we ought to consider a stakeholder interest and incentives. Interests and incentives that affect the research of academics and science no less than in the humanities. The shoddy research of university professors, which is repeated ad nauseum by journalists. So what I see at hand, and we may differ here, but a serious case of what I used to call Christophobia, but deophobia. In other words, you have to explain everything in a naturalistic sense, even if the evidence points in a completely different direction, because there are stakeholder interests.
Yes. I am actually preparing a would-be second volume, and I've come across the same feeling that you've had, that there is a kind of deophobia, a kind of resignation to the fact that God is something of the past and it is not something that we as modern rational human beings have to contend with. And so I would agree there. And I've tried in my latest book to give a kind of snapshot of Oxford in the 1850s and 60s, the events surrounding the famous debate between Wilberforce and Huxley and so on, Huxley being Darwin's representative, to try and see what changed in the national psyche between those times and why it was that such a flimsy idea as natural selection was able to gain ascendancy, not without problems, but certainly over time, people began to pile into it as a kind of valid explanation of our existential condition, so to speak. So I would agree with you in that respect.
How is it, as you put it, that a less than stellar schoolboy and student came upon that theory which others had sought unsuccessfully for more than a century before his birth?
Yes, this is a strange one. What happened is there were a number of books on evolution, some of which had been authored by Darwin's own grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, and others in the 1840s, which made evolution something that was in the air. And that's maybe part of the answer to your question, my question, as to why, because people had been already softened up by the idea of evolution of some sort to come into it. But when Robert Chambers wrote his book on evolution in the mid-1840s, he was a Scottish man of affairs, a literary man as well. He came up with a number of ideas, but he didn't put forward what was known as the vera causa, the real cause, the actuating mechanism which could trigger evolution. And I think that both Darwin and his competitors, as it turned out, Wallace, were interested in being able to put their hand on such a lever in order to explain how changes could come about in naturalistic terms. And I think that in a way it was a kind of, I say in the book, they were acting just as much as conquistadors as actual dispassionate scientists. They were trying to get one over on all previous publishers in the realm of evolution in order to say, aha, now we have found the real cause, the vera causa of why evolution should occur. So I think there was a kind of macho, perhaps even chauvinistic idea that, you know, that the British Empire, which had corralled so much of the globe, was now leading the way in science, in biological science as well, in such a way, I think that Darwin was thinking that it could compete legitimately with geology as a perfectly down-to-earth natural science in the way that Darwin was just as keen on geology as on biology in his earlier years anyway. And he felt that perhaps that he was raising the status of biology to a truly scientific level.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you bring out in the book so importantly is that after Darwin, you had this false antagonism between religion and science that moved to sort of the forefront of people's thinking. And so you had this idea that miracles certainly weren't possible. Everything could be explained through natural processes. Whereas before, the idea was that miracles were not only possible, but they were necessary to make sense of the universe that we inhabit. I mean, the beginning of life, the information of the genetic code, irreducible complexity in biological systems, the phenomenon of the human mind and so forth. All of these things pointed to the possibility of miracles, but now everything becomes naturalistic and you have this bifurcation and battle between science and religion that hadn't been there before, at least not to the extent that it came to be after Darwin.
No, and even in Darwin's day, many of Darwin's own inner circle, who were themselves explorers and scientists in their own right, did not actually accept Darwin, or if they did accept Darwin, it was under what the French called Eurasia. Yes, we accept part of what he's saying, but we reserve the right to issue a kind of minority report of our own. And many of those so-called disciples of Darwin were interested in advancing a form of theistic evolution for the very reasons that you've given, that while what we observe today might go on naturalistically, there must have been an initial impetus to give it shape and form and the kind of complexity that you refer to there. So, yes, I think possibly the kind of gimlet-eyed doctrinaire zealots that we associate with Darwinism these days, and you may know who I'm talking about, but I will not mention his name.
Does it start with a D?
It might well. We're not represented so much until the period after the so-called New Synthesis, after the 1920s. I think really from 1860 to 1920, Darwinian ideas were debated as part of a discussion document. That's how many people regarded it. And even Darwin himself, you remember, he issued 6 editions in all of his Origin of Species, each time trying to sort of make things right with those people who had disagreed with this, that, and the other. And so it's as if he himself was not sure of his own ground. And I mean, one of the ways that he wasn't sure of his own ground was the whole matter of his Christian faith, which has been done to death, I'm aware, many times. But I think it is worth talking about maybe in this context, because he had this kind of riven mind about it. He was, one foot was in the sort of the Christian camp and the other in the atheist camp. And he wasn't really able to square those things, to reconcile those two things, right up until the date of his death in 1882. And we may think, well, this is a bit funny, isn't it? Because intelligent people usually come to some kind of resolution of their crises of faith or whatever they are. But that's not necessarily the case, because one of Darwin's near contemporaries, George Eliot, the Mary Ann Evans, the author who took a male pseudonym, is known for having been a great agnostic, humanist, you call it what you like. But as a critical cockshoot pointed out many years ago in 1964 in his book on the English agnostics, that Mary Ann Evans, George Eliot, Even though she gave up a formal belief in Christian faith and so on, she yet held on very vividly to a notion of providence, the idea that things were going to go in the right direction. And that is only really possible, if you think about it, if you have some kind of residual sort of faith. And I think the same can be applied mutatis mutandis to Darwin. He was a Victorian as well. They were of the same generation. And this was the kind of thought way of that particular zeitgeist.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that ought to be pointed out is that, from my perspective at least, and I'd be interested in yours, it seems to me that Darwin, as you point out, was involved in the Christian faith. In fact, he
yes.
said that when he set out on the HMS Beagle, he was a Bible-believing creationist, and he said he did not then, at that point, doubt the strict and literal truth of every word in the Bible. Now, what's interesting about that is it seems to me that Darwin read the Bible in a wooden literalistic fashion, out of which comes nothing but nonsense. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing applies to how he read the book of nature. So he read the Bible incorrectly, but he also read the book of nature incorrectly. Both are a fundamentalism a fundamentalism, you might say, on the right and a fundamentalism on the left, but both fundamentalism, not following truth wherever it leads, but rather reading something in a way that it ought not to be read. And as a result of that, I mean, there are people like Malcolm Muggeridge who say that science could be as dogmatic as any church and with less justification, and its devotees as bigoted as any country clergyman, a quote that you have in the book.
Yes. Yes, that's right. He did write that in a biography, yes, Samuel Butler, yeah. I think that people have tried to disentangle the confusions of Darwin's religious views many times over. And I must say that I think that we have to accept that, I think there was a critic, an American critic called Neil Gillespie, who wrote about his epistemological double vision, that he retained that to the end of his days. I mean, in my latest book, what I've been quite fascinated, I mean, it's one of the cases where my previous incarnation as a literary critic has come in. When Darwin, and nobody else has commented on this as far as I know, when Darwin went aboard the Beagle originally in the 1830s, one of the books that he took with him, and he said it was his most favorite resource or some words to that effect, was Milton's Paradise Lost. Now, the point about Milton's Paradise Lost, it's an absolutely gorgeous verse epic. It's a bit like hearing organ music, it's most sonorous in English verse. But the point about Paradise Lost is that many people, Milton himself, said that he was writing it as a theodicy to justify the works of God to men, as he put it in his introduction. But some later critics, and not only just later critics, but many contemporary critics, and most signally an English critic of the 1930s called William Empson, in his book called Milton's God, have suggested quite the opposite, that the true hero of Paradise Lost is not God, who comes over as a rather legalistic kind of person, I have to admit, but rather Satan himself, who is this kind of rebel thrown out of heaven with the rebellious angels, and some of whose lines are really worthy of all revolutionaries, some modern like Che Guevara or whoever you like. They are sort of classic incendiary revolutionary rhetoric. And William Empson and others have said that this is really where Darwin was at. He had a kind of grudging respect for Satan as the one who had set himself up against the Christian God. So I think one has to conclude at the end of the day that Darwin's thinking, such as it was a bit of a mess. He was not a crisp theologian. He wasn't a really sharp conceptual thinker or philosopher in the way that we would define that term in the 20th and 21st centuries. He was somebody who simply suffered with the rest of us sometimes as not knowing quite what they meant or even where they were coming from. Mentally me speaking, that is, spiritually speaking.
Well said. I want to talk about the fossil record, something that you address in the book. Carl Linnaeus, who is the father of biological taxonomy, he made it plain in the 18th century that species do not change and that all living things were created as they can be observed today.
Yes.
So the fossil record, according to Carl Linnaeus, says no to the Darwinian superstructure. It is in direct contrast with what Darwin said. And as you look farther into the fossil record, you see that the fossil record has been an embarrassment to Darwin. Darwin had an excuse, I've often said, but people like Dawkins do not. The fossil record is an embarrassment to Darwinian evolution.
Yes. It was very much an embarrassment to Darwin. He actually adverts to it very directly in his Origin of Species when he says that one would expect that nature would be in an uproar, that we would have a process of gradual hybridization with gradations between species, and that this would be reflected in the fossil record. Well, of course, the fossil record does not reflect that at all. It is most un-Darwinian. I mean, after the so-called Cambrian explosion 540 million years ago, you have a sudden appearance of fully formed species. And this is very difficult to account for, which is why Stephen Jay Gould and Eldridge came out with their alternative theory of punctuated equilibrium, as you'll know very well, that perhaps evolution was not as gradual as Darwin would like it to have been. But he was aware of it. But the strange thing is that he's very open-hearted about it. He brings this into his book. And I sometimes wonder whether this is the reason that people have forgiven him this inconsistency, because he was so transparent and so honest that they've given him a pass on that, which is rather silly because, you know, to give somebody a pass on something of such importance, it's not a matter of sportsmanship. It's a matter of truth, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think what's really important, and you've alluded to Richard Dawkins, but here you have Darwin's best-known modern expositor, who is, from my perspective, and I think from yours as well, essentially deceitful and illogical. He is a person who knows about molecular biology, which shows that the humblest bacterium contains more genetic information than the instruction manual for NASA space probes. So he's aware of things that Darwin was not aware of.
Yes.
And yet he continues to hoodwink people.
Yes. I mean, the point is, I don't know whether he's hoodwinking other people as much as he's hoodwinking himself, to be honest. I think he is doctrinaire, I think he is a zealot, but I would hesitate to accuse him of dishonesty in that precise sense, because I think that he is so overinvested in the idea that he is not trying to fool other people so much as he's trying to fool himself. I mean, one of the things that he said in either The Blind Watchmaker, I think it was The Blind Watchmaker rather than Climbing Mount Improbable, was that this whole business about so-called abiogenesis, the emergence of life from chemical combinations and reactions, that he said, well, we haven't managed to do this yet. There are all sorts of other irons in the fire, like thermal vents and so on, where we're hoping that some clues might come. And then he says, rather piteously at the end, we haven't had such a result so far, but perhaps we will in the future. Well, this kind of promissory note on what might happen in the future, it sounds a bit pathetic to me. And it sounds to me like somebody who is so desperate to have his version of things represented in the historical record that he can't actually see behind it or beyond it to give a sense of perspective. And I'm surprised, as you are, that people, especially since the invention of the electron microscope in the mid-1940s and its implementation, I mean, the idea of the various micro-universes that have come into being that Darwin couldn't have known about, but which we know about full well, and you would think, yes, people would factor that into their analyses, but the old guard apparently do not. And it's a matter of regret, but there's nothing that you or I can do about it, presumably.
Yeah, you know, to be an evolutionist today, you have to believe that nothing creates everything, that life comes from non-life, and that the life that comes from non-life created metaphysical realities. And yet, as Louis Pasteur made plain, only life can produce life. And
yes.
I bring this up in the context of the 1953 Miller-Urey experiment, which Time magazine breathlessly touted as a major breakthrough. Mm-hmm. So now, for the first time, we have evidence that non-life can produce life. Talk about the misinformation with respect to that experiment.
Yes, it was done by two reputable scientists in the University of Chicago, as you know. And
it was really an attempt to defy what I would call the triple lock, which had been put on the idea of life coming from non-life, which came not only from Pasteur in the 19th century, but from the British scientist William Harvey, who discovered the circulation of blood back in the 17th century, and also by the Italian Francesco Redi, which is why I call it a triple lock. All of them found that experiments to try and indicate that life could, I don't know, emerge from soiled linen or whatever, were absolute nonsense. This could not happen. And I think, really, it's a very strange one. It's one of these false scientific ideas that's put into a kind of cryogenic freezing, or it's put on a kind of life support mechanism, intellectually speaking. And what happened, I think, in the 20th century, which became essentially for many people a non-Christian century, was that Haldane and Oparin, British and Russian scientists, had said in the 1920s that well, perhaps we could see whether this works, you know, after all. And I think what happened was that the idea didn't die out completely, because there was a really bizarre experiment in 1947 in the University of California, carried out by one Robert Cornish, to try and resuscitate an executed criminal. And he would have gone ahead with that had not the university authorities rather sensibly stood in to stop him. Anyway, all this was the prelude, I think, to the Miller-Urey experiment of 1953, which again tried to flout all respectable and not just empirically proven scientific findings about whether life could come from non-life. It was an heroic experiment. It didn't work. People wanted it to work. They willed it to work so hard that some people like Carl Sagan said, rather hopefully, that it had worked in a manner of speaking. Well, it didn't really. And one of the things that I noticed is that some time ago, almost half a century ago, when one has to say now, the film came out, a Mel Brooks film, a comedy called Young Frankenstein, which is all about, you know, the original Mary Frankenstein thing and about whether you can bring back a creature to life, or, and by implication, whether you can create life and so on. And you may know the film, others may know the film. It's very entertaining. There's a lot of goonery in it, a lot of nonsense in it. But at the end of the day, when Mel Brooks was interviewed for a biography in 2019, he said there was a serious purpose in this, and that was to satirize the idea that life could come from non-life. He felt that this was illegitimately trying to play God, or words to that effect, is what he said to the journalist who was interviewing him in 2019. So I think it's a very strange one. People will have beliefs that are not borne out by the evidence, but which they still hold on to, because I think it promises a kind of materialistic explanation for reality, which unfortunately for them is not there.
Yeah, it's not there. And so there is this grasping at straws. One of the examples of that would be panspermia. This has become a very popular explanation for the origin of life on Earth. Mm-hmm. Talk about panspermia. A lot of people may not know the term.
No.
But this is something that has become increasingly popular in our era, both from the perspective of directed panspermia and, you know, the notion that this just wafted in our direction as a result of meteors.
Yes. Again, this is a very strange one. I would again say, perhaps rather, I hope I'm not being too insulting when I say it, but I think it is one of these ideas that's kept alive artificially as a sort of cryogenic experiment in a way, because what happened was that even going back to 1903, when the idea in the modern era was put forward of panspermia, of the what it means is that life, people having given up the idea of trying to look for some chemical abiogenesis on Earth, have said, oh, well, maybe life appeared from outer space. And so what happened was that the idea was, and it's a purely theoretical one, it's a bit like the multiverse, it only exists in people's imagination. And that is that life could have been so seeded from outer space as a result of the equivalent of convection currents. You know, this sort of life could have been encrusted in a boulder or something as a meteorite and then somehow found itself here on Earth. So the person who had a very strange relationship with the idea of panspermia was the legendary British cosmologist Sir Fred Hoyle, who himself is on record as having said there's nothing so stupid in science as the idea that a random coming together of chemicals could produce the first cells of life here on Earth. But apparently he did not wish to risk his scientific good name by implying that there was some kind of God explanation for things. And so he succumbed to the temptations of putting forward panspermia as an idea of his own. He actually lent his prestigious name to this rather lunatic, it seems to me, idea. And it goes to show, I think, that when we're in the dark about things, we can reach out, as you say, for the most strange straws to cling on to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was thinking also about how you have been able to sift through all of this, and you have a chapter in your book on the challenge of intelligent design. And So many people today are saying that the intelligent design theorists, many of whom are my friends, that they're smuggling religion into the picture under the banner of scientific credibility. And nothing could be farther from the truth. There's an epigraph in your book that says, if the world's finest minds can unravel only with difficulty the deeper workings of nature, how could it be supposed that those workings are merely a mindless accident, a product of blind chance? That's said by theoretical physicist Paul Davies. So
yes.
The point I want to drive at here is that in very many cases, the working of nature cannot be unraveled, and Darwin and later biologists have tended to paper over the cracks of their own knowledge, as opposed to taking seriously the possibility of intelligent design. And I bring this up in this capacity because I felt that your book was quite honest in this regard, that you opened up the doorway to intelligent design being not something that is speculative, but something that is warranted by the evidence.
Yes, I do think that. I mean, what I said in the book was really, since the evidence can be a bit elusive and ambiguous in many cases, I said that, you know, the old idea of nescience, which was a word used in the early modern period of English, but for meaning we do not know, and it didn't mean ignorance, just meant we do not know, was one possible way of going. But one has to admit that at the end of the day, if you're looking at the empirical evidence, and this is what a number of scientists have brought out far better than I could, then I think that the indices concerning complexity really trump the idea of nescience. I think there must be some kind of actuating force and indeed intelligence behind such things. I am not in a position to say what that intelligence might be any more than the great theologian Thomas Aquinas was in the early 13th century, or than the English mystics, the English mystic who wrote The Cloud of Unknowing, which sort of brought onto the agenda the kind of negative or apophatic theology by which you can derive a notion of a superior power, but you can't necessarily fill in the gaps or say of what precise nature that superior power is. I think this is an open question, logically speaking, but again, logically speaking, I think there's a case for saying that such an entity must exist.
I think if you had a good long conversation with your wife, as Darwin probably should have had with Emma, maybe some of these mysteries can be cleared up. Just joking.
But maybe.
You know, you got to listen to your wife, right? You know, I want to bring up A few things in this regard. I mean, when we're talking about intelligent design, and you bring them up in the book, language. The kind of obfuscation that people in the scientific community have made with respect to language, I think, is unworthy of their prowess academically. How can you explain away the complex linguistic capacities and say that these complex linguistic capacities evolved from ape-like communication? I mean, that's one of the most amazing things that is still communicated in the academy, and we should certainly know better at this stage of human history.
Yeah, I mean, I think this again is a very strange and problematical facet. As early as the 1860s themselves, just after Darwin's writings began to be known, there was a then renowned Oxford professor of Indo-European philology called Friedrich Max Müller, who said that he felt that human communication, since it is not dependent on simple onomatopoeic grunts, that is, which suggests mood, not any more advanced intellectual content, that is, you could not extrapolate from that the kind of hyper-sophisticated language that you and I are using now could possibly derive from an ape-like ancestor. I mean, Darwin himself in The Descent of Man says that, maybe some ape ended up, he doesn't say how, with a superior brain and that this was passed on. Well, you know, this is pure conjecture and there is absolutely no line of causation between the kind of linguistic capacities that you and I have and what our ape-like cousins, as they say, have. Also, this is a point that actually was brought up more recently by the renowned linguist Noam Chomsky, when he said, I don't know whether he was taking issue with Darwinism as such, but he stated that human communication was a very complex kind, and that it might indeed be inborn in the human infant, so that, for instance, you can talk in English or Chinese or whatever language, but the ability to do so is somehow inborn. Therefore, how did it become inborn if it isn't inborn in our simian cousins? The line of transmission from simian to human is huge. Darwin would call it a saltation, a huge leap, a leap of faith to think that any simian grunts and groans could ever have formed the basis of the human language.
Yeah, I mean, we were hardwired for grammar from birth. And that's hard to explain through the evolutionary process, as is the sophistication of the human brain, which I thought you did a terrific job of explicating in your book.
I think it was Michael Denton who did the explicating. I gave a very lengthy quote from him, which I think was marvelous. I don't see how anybody can counter it, to be honest. It was so marvelous.
Yeah, I think what is written in your book in this regard, when you think about the awe-inducing complexity of the human brain, no kind of hyperbole can do it justice. And I've tried to explain this in various venues, but I, again, think that, with the quotes that you have and so forth, but you're pulling it all together. You've done a marvelous job in your book. You've made a great contribution by the way you banded it all together, so that people can see just how impossible it is to suppose that natural selection and common descent can in some way account for the sophistication of the human brain. You also, I think, have done a great job and a great service of demonstrating substance dualism, that the mind and the brain are separate entities. I mean, how do you explain what people can explain today, how the mind can cause the physical synapses of the brain to fire in the first place?
That is a mystery, yes.
It is a mystery, and it is a mystery that I think evolutionists ought to take seriously. I mean, a lot of people are physicalists, and they say the physical facts fix all the facts, but I don't think you can say that in an age of scientific enlightenment.
I don't think you can. A book I've been reading recently by a neurologist called Donald Hoffman, one F, two N's, Donald Hoffman, it's something called Darwinism and the Denial of Reality, or something like that. I've got it here somewhere. And Hoffman, he worked together with Francis Crick, who was the, as you know, the co-discoverer of DNA. And this could only have been in the latter decades of the 20th century, because Crick is not alive any longer. And Crick said more or less, he was rather a sort of buccaneering sort, as I understand it. I've cracked DNA, now I'm going to crack the brain and consciousness. And of course, he didn't get anywhere near doing so, because, to use a word you've used, the physicalist conception of what the brain consists in does not really hit the mark when you're talking about these ultra subtle responses that human beings have. In fact, Hoffman quotes somebody else who said that if you look at the physical aspects of the brain, to say that you can somehow deduce from that or postulate from that the whole panoply of human thought and emotion is like saying you can derive numbers from biscuits or ethics from rhubarb. You know, the two are incommensurable. There's a whole dimension that we don't know of in the brain, just as about 96% of the outer cosmos represents dark energy and dark matter. So I would say more than 96% of the brain is totally inscrutable to us.
Yes, that's absolutely right. You know, something that you bring out in the book that I think would be worth elaborating on is Alfred Russel Wallace, who was a contemporary of Darwin.
Yes.
In fact, he might have beat Darwin to the punch with publication, but didn't.
Mm-hmm.
He had a conversion experience from naturalism to intelligent design, much like you have had.
Mm-hmm.
But this was based on the idea that not only humanity, but the entire cosmos had been intelligently crafted. You discuss in the book what ignited that change. So you have Wallace parting company with Darwin on the subject of the human mind. He cited his inability to comprehend how unconscious processes should be able to produce consciousness. So he was, as I was talking about before, he was convinced that the mind and the body were really distinct and discrete entities. And so he had a conversion experience. He went in one direction. Darwin continued in the other direction, although, as you have pointed out, he was very confused and confabulated in his own writing about this.
Yes, yes. I mean, I have, further to writing the book, I have considered Wallace. I've had some more thoughts and more research to do about Wallace. He was a totally different kettle of fish. I mean, you've got to remember, with Wallace, he did not have a background such as Darwin had. I mean, I'm talking about Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who was the foremost person to put forward the idea of evolution in England. And Darwin, I feel, all the more so because he didn't always give credit to his grandfather as much as he should have, felt himself somehow in a sort of family competition that he had to find the answer to this $64,000 question as to how evolution could occur. And once he felt, or he fancied, that he'd found it, he had to cling to it like for grim death. Now, Wallace was a totally different sort of person. He was simply an intelligent young man without any great means. He came of a rather impoverished family, a sort of impoverished, genteel kind of background in a way. And he had a tremendous interest in life in the greater sense. I mean, for instance, I mean, when Darwin bowed out of public affairs in around about 1870, he devoted himself to this rather safe exploration of barnacles. Well, Wallace, of course, became a public intellectual. He made some really distinctive contributions to cosmology. And in a way, what had happened in his earlier life was a previous chapter. And he did not feel the same sense of family territory to be defended at whatever cost, because his grandfather had not been distinguished evolutionist and so on. So he was, I think, more open-minded. And I think also, when you say he had a conversion experience, I would say that that conversion experience came rather slowly, because at one time he indulged in a kind of dualism, didn't he? He said that the body could be the result of natural selection, but the mind certainly couldn't be. And, you know, he was arraigned at the time for so-called dualism, for, you know, this stark distinction between the mind and the body. And it was only later in life, and remember, he lived from 1913, right out of his era in a way, it was only latterly that he was prepared to concede that the whole of the created order must have had a creator in that sense.
You know, one of the things I want to talk about as well in this podcast is the ramifications of social Darwinism. Three particular categories: racism, sexism, and eugenics. The racism of Darwin's theory, pretty pronounced. In The Descent of Man, for example, he speculated that at some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. And
yes, he wasn't advocating it. He was just saying that it was a fait accompli, that it was something natural, wasn't he? I understand.
Yeah, although in many senses, I mean, this whole idea of racism was advocated. If you look at the history of evolution, it was advocated in many venues, and I can talk about that in a few minutes, but I want to leave that for just a moment and just augment what I said about racism with sexism.
Mm-hmm.
Darwin was very clearly a sexist. He viewed women as essentially less perfectly evolved versions of men.
Yes.
He famously said that the chief distinction in the intellectual powers of the two sexes is shown by men attaining to a higher eminence in whatever a man takes up than can a woman, and that the average of mental power in man must be above that of women. And then with respect to eugenics, Darwin's subjective spin, I think, led to that nightmare. The idea that the gene pool was being corrupted by the less fit genes of inferior people began to have widespread support. It was supported by the National Academy of Sciences, the American Medical Association. Mm-hmm. It was funded by Carnegie and Rockefeller. It was supported even by presidents like Teddy Roosevelt. And with this idea of eugenics, I mean, you had the notion that the gene pool was being corrupted by the less fit genes of inferior people. And in order to thwart that unfortunate condition, you had to get rid of those people. And so eugenics became a blight on civilization, but it followed, in my perspective at least, naturally from the theory of evolution.
Yes, I think you're right. It's not something I adverted to directly in the book, except in the sense that I said that the sociobiology that we associate with the 1970s, with E.O. Wilson and so on, has been arraigned for precisely the kind of divisiveness and racialism and sexism, even Nazism, some people have said, or quasi-Nazism, and I wouldn't wish to dissent from that. In fact, in my own family background, I mean, my maternal grandparents were part of the farming community in the 1930s. And of course, they were used to looking at things from a reductionist animal point of view. And I know that my late mother said that my grandfather, for instance, in the 1930s, was quite an admirer of Hitler, and that eugenics seemed to be a perfectly logical way of arranging human affairs. So I think that there is a line, as you say, especially from The Descent of Man, where Darwin speculates rather more freely than he did in his original Origin of Species about things, especially about human life. I think that there is a straight line from Darwin and to such later developments. The strange thing is, and one of the things I'm looking at the moment, I'll just put this in parenthesis, is I've begun to be interested in the way that sociobiology has been excoriated so much, and yet Darwinism has remained untouched by many critical voices that you would otherwise think would criticize it more. It seems to be a sort of inconsistency, since we've already established, I think, that the two are indissolubly linked, intellectually speaking.
I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, I'm thinking about the 20th century in which eugenics was standard fare in high school biology classes. And the classic example, and you actually allude in your book to the 1925 Scopes monkey trial, but you have George William Hunter's textbook, A Civic Biology. I think we ought to note very carefully, because this is the infamous biology text at the center of that trial. John Scopes used that very text to convince impressionable students that humanity has an evolutionary hierarchy, that at present time there exist upon the earth five races or varieties of man. And then the text makes a stirring case for the pseudoscience of eugenics, goes so far as to say that the remedy for those not well born should be extermination. So again, the idea is an idea that had real significance, certainly in America, with this civic biology text.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think, I mean, of course, you can draw a line to the Nazi extermination camps and to the forced sterilization endeavors which took place in the United States earlier in the 20th century as well. Yes, I think that these were intellectually coherent from a Darwinian perspective, yes.
You have some delicious monikers in your book, including materialistic magic. You use that word magic several times in the book. Talk about the materialistic magic that's part and parcel of the Darwinian paradigm.
Well, I think it really goes back to whether you think that things can emerge by some kind of occult automatism, as in magic shows for children and adults, and even to the modern day, or if you feel obligated to be able to put your finger on exactly the process or the lever or the mechanism which causes these things in the first place. And one of my gripes is with the too glib assumption that you can elide, that is, leave out many parts of your chain of reasoning in order to simply postulate that such a progression must have occurred. Often the word must have, would have, probably would have. This is the kind of thing. As a self-styled rationalist, this does not sit well with me. I need to be able to have the proof of things. And the fact that that proof is not forthcoming, I find deeply suspicious. I mean, one of the things I've thought about, because for many large tranches of my life, I've counted myself as a rationalist, is why on earth, when the philosophical current which you associate most strongly with rationalism, that is logical positivism, the ideas of Sir Alfred Ayer and his Language, Truth, and Logic of 1936, and the Vienna Circle, and all that sort of stuff in the early 20th century, why is it that when they were inclined to call all manifestations of religion nonsense, they'd spelt this as non-sense. And what they meant, they weren't being scurrilous. What they were saying was, this does not stand up to rational analysis. Okay, I can understand from their perspective where they were coming from. But why did they never attack Darwinism on the same grounds, which has even less empirical support, that seems to me, than many of the major world religions does? And it wasn't until I was reading a book, rereading a book recently by a philosopher called Richard Spilsbury. It's a critique of Darwinism, which came out, I think it was OUP 1974, so some time ago now. He said that he had had the same wonder as to why the logical positivists had not attacked Darwinism, since they've attacked every other person in the universe for being subpar logically. And Spilsbury said that basically he felt this was because, even though they might have felt that Darwinism was questionable, they did not wish to question it because it all contributed to the kind of materialist worldview that the logical positives held on other grounds themselves. And that seems to me all too plausible, because it chimes very exactly with what happened with Darwin's famous bulldog, Thomas Huxley, who himself, right up until the end of his days, he believed in evolution in some way or other, but he did not believe in natural selection. But yet he was Darwin's greatest defender. Darwin felt that Huxley soft-pedaled natural selection in his talking about evolution, and Huxley tried to apologize into his beard about that sometimes, but he still, in his heart of heart, he did not believe in natural selection. So I think it's quite possible that the logical positivists would not have believed in natural selection, could have thought it was as much of a load of old nonsense as I think it. But they stayed silent because they had another agenda, and that was the materialist, non-theistic outlook on life.
Yeah, that's right. I want you to talk a little bit more about your fellow Brit, Richard Dawkins. He says that the universe we observe has precisely the properties that we would expect if there is, at the bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Mm. You, by contrast, make a strong case for Earth being a privileged planet, that the Earth is fine-tuned for habitability, that the Earth is uniquely blessed. What are we to make of the squabble between the two Brits?
Well, I'm not a scientist like Dawkins is. I'm simply, I hope, an unbiased member, foreman of the jury, who's making an independent audit of what the scientists have done. But anyway, yes, I think this is a strange one. Basically, Dawkins, inasmuch as he, many people have said he's a stranger to philosophy. Well, he might be a stranger to philosophy in the technical sense, but I think that his philosophical mentor was one Bertrand Russell from the early 20th century. Russell was a strange man. He had begun his life in faith, but had lost his faith and had become rather embittered by it. And he'd become a kind of blank and blanket atheist. And he was predisposed to see the heavens and the earth through the filter of that atheism. And it is true that if you look outside this orb that we're privileged enough to inhabit, I mean, all you can see outside is a kind of gigantic and destructive pinball machine of planets and meteors and fire and destruction and so on. And I think that, yes, it was really from the 1970s that people were minded to connect the dots and to see that there were these cosmological constants, the so-called Goldilocks zone. That cliche has been done to death, I know that, but the fact that the Earth is not too hot, not too cold, it has plentiful provisions thus far, unless we use them all up, which I hope we don't. And so nobody seemed to have that perspective on things, or not enough people had that perspective until the 70s. And I think what Dawkins and his mentor Russell were going back to was a time before cosmologists had looked at this problem four square and were inclined to lump together the Earth with the exterior cosmos. And I think that the Earth and the exterior cosmos are incommensurable in that sense. I mean, the exterior cosmos is a form of hell, in my view, whereas what we've got here, even though we mess it up hugely, is a potentially extremely productive and maybe even blessed place. So I think what we've got here is a difference in zeitgeist. I think that Dawkins, going back to Russell, is looking back at a period in cosmology when, before the distinction between the privileged planet and the rest of the universe had been foregrounded so much and was more inclined to speak from that rather, I would say, antiquated philosophical and cosmological position. Yeah, I think that's what I would say to that one.
Well said. Something that you mentioned earlier on in our conversation was the multiverse hypothesis. And I want to go back to that. Is that just a cop-out? With biological evolution, the cop-out is always given enough time, anything is possible. And in the same train of thought, people are saying given an infinite number of universes, again, mm-hmm. anything is possible.
Well, I mean, you should be perhaps talking to some of the brain boxes who come out with this kind of thing rather than to a retired liberal arts professor on this subject. But from what I can see, and I have tried to undertake an independent audit, as I say, of what, you know, people cleverer than myself have said on this subject. For a start, the idea of a multiverse is not a new idea, surprisingly enough. It goes right back to Greek antiquity, when some philosophers, who were really brainstormers in those days, of course, said that the universe might be issuing separate worlds, sort of like a bubble goes into a number of bubbles and that kind of thing. That's where that comes from. But yes, I suppose it is a cop-out in as much as people have said it's a kind of cosmic natural selection, that if you postulate the universe as being a conglomerate of different worlds, then maybe somebody had to get lucky. I don't find this a very strong argument. I find it a rather facile and glib argument myself for why we should be in this fortunate position. But that's what people say. And I also think that a number of ideas, I don't think that Darwinism is in fact a modern idea. I think that the idea of chance, or in his case, natural selection, you know, with the chance mutations and so on, giving it a modern spin as he did, goes back to Greek antiquity, to Epicurus and his Roman disciple Lucretius, who said that the world that we know is a conglomeration of atoms all reacting in different ways, and that in some way, certain results, certain patterns would come about, whether you wanted them to or not, that there was a kind of, well, I would call it automatism, I mean, and maybe even magic in that kind of thinking, that it is magical thinking. But this is what they said. And the strange thing was that the Lucretian idea of chance chimed very nicely with the Darwinian idea of evolution, which also depends on chance to an unconscionable degree, as most of us would think. And really, what happened at that point is that many of the older philosophers of antiquity, like Plato, Aristotle, the early physician Galen, who had complete contempt for the Lucretian idea of things emerging by chance, somehow gained credibility by being linked to the claimed scientific nature of Darwinism. And it was only on the basis of that, I think, that people thought, oh, well, Lucretianism is a pretty strange idea, but perhaps if it's backed up by modern science in the form of Darwinism, oh, perhaps we'd better pile into that and believe it now. That's one way, I think, in which an illogical idea has implanted itself in Western consciousness since the 1860s, and more especially from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s of the last century.
Yeah, good point. And I think just as the ancients, you know, they had the materialistic concept, nothing new under the sun. What Darwin wrote about, he got from a lot from his grandfather Erasmus, who was a polymath.
Yes.
And then, as you say, I mean, you go back to the ancients and find the same sort of idea percolating. On the other hand, the ancients also talked about the fact that the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands, or God's eternal power, divine nature, clearly seen through what has been made, and therefore human beings are without excuse. I want to go to chapter 5 of your book, which is titled The Mystery of Mysteries, and just read a series of questions that you pose and have you comment. You pose these questions, and I'll read them in rapid fashion. How did a once barren terrestrial environment give rise to life forms? How did the resources deemed necessary to the process, self-replicating molecules bearing genetic information, arise in the first place? What is the ultimate origin of the genetic code, and who or what directed it to produce plant and animal species? Why are we safely cocooned in the cosmic Goldilocks zone when so many parts of the universe are more reminiscent of, as you pointed out earlier, Dante's Inferno? Mm-hmm. Where do the laws of physics come from? What was before the Big Bang, and why is there something rather than nothing? Is it fair to say that the notion that the physical facts fix all the facts doesn't stand up to common sense in light of those questions that you raise?
I think what I was writing about there is essentially the existential imponderables, which we may never know the answer to. I think that especially, and I'm talking about outside my subject area now, but what I've been able to read and glean, the ideas of quantum physics and mechanics, in which so much is uncertain, tenuous and probabilistic rather than certain in the ways that we're accustomed to from the Newtonian conceptions of unbroken laws and so on, mean that the underlying reality of our existence, and remember that the quantum world refers to the invisible world, which we didn't even know existed till 75 years ago, because the Newtonian big world is undergirded by the quantum world, then it would be foolish to suggest that anybody could have a complete answer to some of these imponderables. I think that was the point I was making. Or did you wish to ask me another question?
No. I think that covers it. You know, I'm basically asking for an elaboration on what the Oxford mathematician John Lennox said, that the laws of physics are descriptive and predictive, but yes, not creative in their own right. In other words, you know, you can have an explanation of gravity, but you can never communicate that gravity created gravity.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think that John Lennox was sort of crossing swords there with Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow in a 2012 book they put out, in which they said that certain things could be understood in a purely materialistic way. But I think what John Lennox then said, well, yes, but how do you explain these very basic things like the law of gravity and so on? Well, you can't. It's just there. You can't get beyond that.
I often say that contrast is the conduit to clarity. And I want to make a contrast here. If you follow the Darwinian tributary that has come to dominate the academy, you have to conclude that the universe quite literally created itself.
Yes.
If you follow Einstein, I think he has a more dignified acknowledgement, the acknowledgement that the laws of nature manifest the existence of a spirit vastly superior to that of humanity, and one in the face of which we with our modest powers must feel humble. And I think the contrast here between the academy, which seems to me to be boastful, and Einstein, who was a superior intellect, far more humble in light of the evidence that surrounded him.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I was recently reading a biography of Einstein by one Max Jammer. That's spelled Jammer. It's a German word. J is pronounced as a Y. And he goes into this quite a bit. And the notion that certain abstract qualities, if you buy into certain abstract postulations, there's got to be an element of faith in it. And I think that probably Einstein saw as much as anybody else did, or perhaps better than many of his colleagues did, that there was a necessity for this. I mean, the alternative of what you said the academy buys into, I suppose you could gloss it in historical terms as a kind of hubris of trying to claim too much. And I think this is a danger, that we try to claim too much And perhaps in former decades, I tried that too much myself, but it doesn't really work because it doesn't, you can't really convince yourself that the universe created itself, that we are autonomous beings. This is not true. We're extremely dependent. We are, as somebody said, the subjects of the cosmos rather than the rulers of the cosmos.
Something in your book that I want to perhaps conclude with, although it is so delightful to talk to you, I'm thoroughly enjoying the conversation, but let's talk about the overabundance of what you call invisible natural wonders and our own false sense of entitlement about these innumerable benefits. And you mentioned a number of them. You mentioned the liver, the heart, the cells, which are a diminutive universe in each one of these individual cells, as you explain it, eyelids, skin, photosynthesis, and the list goes on. Maybe you can comment on one or a few of these. I mean, the liver in and of itself is able to perform more functions than the largest chemical refinery, as you put it, the autonomous functioning of the heart, the immune system, and on it goes. I mean, we ought to have this sense of wonder, and instead we're stuck in this materialistic paradigm.
Yeah, it's a paradigm that I'm sort of emerging from myself, so I can understand why people would want this. I mean, if you're employed as a scientist, you're employed to find materialistic solutions to problems, but I think there's a limit beyond which you can't. And I do think that, in former decades, I don't know whether the word is complacent or over-entitled, but, you know, one does take one's body for granted. And you do tend to think, well, that it's a kind of entitlement. Oh, yeah, yes, this is just a genetic birthright. But the point is, it is also a multi-miracle in common parlance. I mean, it would be dishonest to say that it were anything but a miracle in the way, in the semantic sense, that we use miracle in everyday parlance. And I think that is the sense of wonder. And I think that was born in upon me by reading the book Why Us by James Lefanu, who's a British retired doctor and medical contributor to the Daily Telegraph, London paper called Daily Telegraph, whom I met recently in London. I'll repeat the title for anyone who's interested, Why Us? And it's a book about the human genome experiment, which he knows far more about than I do, which disappointed many medics like himself because it had not brought us to a right royal route to actually understanding the genetic basis of life. There were so many non-gene explanations for what goes on, and the gene is not in itself. Even if you can explore the gene to its ultimate limits, there are things besides the genes. Epigenetic is the word that they use, epigenetic forces, which we haven't really cottoned onto yet. So the thing is of such huge complexity that I don't know how many lifetimes, millennia, whatever it would ever take. My own opinion is that we will never come to understand these things fully.
I find it the grandest historical irony that the most fervent defenders of Darwinism are claiming to be advancing the ideals of the European Enlightenment. And in the European Enlightenment, the idea was to follow truth wherever it leads. And I think what's happening is precisely the opposite. I think people are stuck in their own psycho-epistemological cocoons. They're wedded to an ideology that promotes a worldview that does not correspond to reality. And so they're not following truth wherever it leads. And yet, they claim to be advancing the dictums of the Enlightenment.
Yes, I think the word enlightenment itself is semantically rather virtue signaling, isn't it? You know, bringing light to what was dark and so on. And I think it defined itself in contradistinction to the so-called superstitions of the Middle Ages. And what its unique selling feature was that it was going to depend on experimental evidence and so on as the clincher, as the game changer for things. And so it should be. Modern experimental science is, at its best, is like that. But Darwin isn't at all like that. It is purely conjectural. And it is counter-indicated by so many factors that it really surprises me that it still holds water in many very intelligent people's minds.
And in your epilogue, and we can conclude with that, you say it is now half a human lifetime since Michael Denton issued his decisive critique of modern evolutionary theory, and yet many biologists continue on business as usual. School textbooks still purvey the same broadly Darwinian interpretation of life, including the presentation of evidences, quote unquote, for evolution that have been long discredited. And I suppose as you end your own book in the epilogue, I suppose I ought to say that I admire you greatly for being willing to bust out of that epistemological cocoon and consider the fact that intelligent design makes more sense in an age of scientific enlightenment than does the materialistic worldview.
I think, paradoxical though that might sound to many people, I agree with you.
Well, you know, I mean, I think for a humanist and a rationalist to write a book as you have written it, first of all, it speaks to your integrity. And secondly, I think, as I said at the very beginning of this podcast, this book is brilliant. It's brilliant not only in how it tackles a subject, but the delightful way in which you use language. Your skill is immense, and I love this book. I seldom read books more than once. I probably should, but this is a book that I've read several times, and I've enjoyed it every single time.
Well, I'm delighted to hear so, and thank you very much for your sympathetic questions, and thanks a bunch.
Well, I hope one day you make the next step to exploring the God who has revealed himself not only in the book of nature, but also in the Bible. The Bible properly read. I think one of the biggest problems with people today is there's a caricature of Scripture. And instead of reading the Bible in the sense in which it is intended, they read it in a wooden, literalistic way in which nothing but nonsense can emerge. And I've gone through this process myself. I, at one time, embraced the materialistic worldview. I looked at the evidence, as I said at the beginning, the evidence for origins. I think this is the most important apologetic issue. How one views their origins will also determine how they live their life. But then I also looked at the Bible as being divine as opposed to merely human in origin. And I came to a completely different understanding of the Bible and its majestic prowess. And then finally, I also looked at the whole idea of revelation, that God is on the one hand ineffable, on the other hand, he has become knowable in incarnation through the person and work of Jesus Christ, and that Jesus Christ demonstrates that he is God through the immutable fact of resurrection. And I think this is something that we don't have to accept on blind faith, but rather, again, by looking at the evidences. So I've made that journey. I hope one day you complete that journey as well.
Oh, thanks for your good wishes. Thank you.
Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the Hank Unplugged podcast and for writing Taking Leave of Darwin. And by the way, I want to read your next book.
Oh.
As soon as I can see that manuscript, the sooner the better.
Well, I'm sort of putting the finishing touches to it. My wife suggested one or two tweaks. And what I did with the other book, I sent it to Michael Behe originally, and he liked it, which surprised me because he's the great expert. And, you know, I was a rank outsider. So I'm thinking James Lefanu has looked at an early version. So I'll bear you in mind, of course. Thank you very much for your endorsement.
Well, I would love to endorse it. I'm sure that I would be as thrilled about that book as I am of your book, Taking Leave of Darwin. And speaking to our audience, I want to say real quickly that, again, this book, available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You get your copy on the web at equip.org. You can also write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Thanks again for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with a further edition of the podcast. So long for now.